Good morning and welcome to today's edition of Times the Brief, brought to you by Spoken Layer. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day.
New Justice League trailer hints at the appearance of a mysterious hero. By Eliana Doctorman. Justice League premiered a new trailer at San Diego Comic-Con, and though we don't see him, the footage suggests Superman might be back. Alfred, Jeremy Irons, is holding down the phone for Batman, Ben Affleck, while the Justice League is out and he looks up from his work. "He said you'd come," he says to the unseen person. "Let's hope it's not too late." Considering Batman vs. Superman director Zack Snyder teased at last year's Comic-Con that Superman would return despite seemingly dying at the end of that film, the mysterious figure could be Superman himself. Or does that reflection in Alfred's eyes indicate a Green Lantern is paying a visit? The footage also teased a return to Themyscira, where we first ventured in Wonder Woman. Some evil spirit lands in Diana's homeland, to her mother's surprise. The cast was overjoyed by the footage. A barefooted Jason Momoa, Aquaman, broke his chair, slamming it on the ground out of excitement. Meanwhile, Ben Affleck enthused, "How many people in their life get to come into Hall H and say that I'm Batman?" The cast members employed different strategies when it came to the Superman secret. When a little boy asked the panel where Superman is, Momoa replied, "I don't know if your parents showed you the last movie, but Superman's dead," to laughs. Gal Gadot was determined to be a little kinder to the boy. "If you're a big fan of Superman, you're going to be very, very happy," she revealed. The footage reassured fans that the movie was on track. Zack Snyder relinquished his position as director on the movie, set to premiere on November 17th after a personal tragedy. Since then, Avengers director Joss Whedon has taken over the project and is skipping Comic-Con in order to finish editing the film. The two directors have very different styles. Snyder's movies tend to be darker, Whedon's quippier. So it's unclear whether Justice League will prove more like the dour Batman vs. Superman or lighter like the quippy Marvel movies. One thing is for sure. Whedon and Warner Brothers are doing their best to capitalize on Wonder Woman's box office success by shining a light on the heroine in the ensemble film.
Five Times a President Issued a Controversial Pardon, by Jack Brewster. President Donald Trump is reportedly contemplating pardoning family members, staffers, and even himself for connections to the Russian investigation. The story, which was reported by the Washington Post, led to criticism. But if Trump follows through with a pardon relating to the investigation, it would not be the first time in history a president has created controversy using the constitutional power. Here's a run-through of notable controversial pardons. 1. President Richard Nixon. Which president pardoned him? Gerald Ford. What was he pardoned for? His crimes relating to the Watergate scandal. President Ford issued a preemptive pardon for Nixon because he had not yet been charged with a crime. Why was it controversial? Ford pardoned Nixon because he wanted the nation to move past Watergate and felt that a president under trial would be cruelly and excessively penalized. But many Americans were upset that Nixon was not tried. Some also speculate that Nixon was pardoned as part of a quid pro quo deal with Ford. Though there was never any evidence for this, Ford lost the next election. 2. Mark Rich. Which president pardoned him? Bill Clinton. What was he pardoned for? His 65 criminal charges, including tax evasion, racketeering, and illegal oil deals with Iran. Rich fled the United States to escape serving consecutive life prison sentences in 1983. Rich was also placed on the FBI's most wanted list for his crimes. Why was it controversial? Rich's ex-wife, Denise Rich, was a major donor for the Democratic Party. Critics argued that Clinton's decision to pardon Rich was influenced by the donations Denise made. In 2005, the FBI concluded that the donations were not a quid pro quo. A week before the 2016 election, the controversy made headlines when a long-dormant FBI Twitter account released the files detailing the investigation. Some argued that the timing of the release was inappropriate given how close it was to the election. 3. Former Chief of Staff to the Vice President, Scooter Libby. He was technically not pardoned, but instead had his 30-month prison term commuted. A commutation is different from a pardon in that it wipes the person's sentence, not their record. Which president commuted him? George W. Bush. What was he guilty of? He was found guilty of perjury, obstruction of justice, and providing false statements to the FBI in the probe of the leaked identity of a CIA operative. Why was it controversial? Democrats argued Bush abused his power and the judicial system to protect a fellow administration member. Libby was the highest-ranking official to be convicted of a felony since the Iran-Contra affair. The move also came at a time when Bush's popularity was extremely low, possibly exacerbating the public outcry to the pardon. 4. Former Secretary of State Caspar Weinberger. Which president pardoned him? George H.W. Bush. What was he pardoned for? Lying under oath to the independent counsel investigating the Iran-Contra affair. Why was it controversial? Bush pardoned 6 government officials involved in the scandal, including Weinberger. Weinberger was the highest profile of the 6 that Bush pardoned. The investigation essentially ended the probe being conducted by the independent counsel. 5. Vietnam draft dodgers. Which president pardoned them? Jimmy Carter. What were they pardoned for? Dodging the draft during the Vietnam War. Why was it controversial? The pardon was a campaign issue in the presidential race between Carter and then-President Ford. Carter promised to deliver an outright pardon to all draft dodgers that had avoided service by leaving the country or not registering. Ford, on the other hand, said he would only give a conditional amnesty. Carter issued the pardon on his first day in office. Many Americans were critical of Carter's decision, especially veterans. Lawmakers agree on sweeping Russia sanctions package by Richard Lardner, AP, Washington. Congressional Democrats announced Saturday that a bipartisan group of House and Senate negotiators have reached an agreement on a sweeping Russia sanctions package to punish Moscow for meddling in the presidential election and its military aggression in Ukraine and Syria. Representative Steny Hoyer of Maryland, the number 2 House Democrat, said lawmakers had settled lingering issues with the bill, which also includes stiff economic penalties against Iran and North Korea. The sanctions targeting Russia, however, have drawn the most attention due to President Donald Trump's persistent push for warmer relations with President Vladimir Putin and ongoing investigations into Russia's interference in the 2016 campaign. Passage of the bill, which could occur before Congress breaks for the August recess, puts Congress on a possible collision course with Trump. The White House had objected to a key section of the bill that would mandate a congressional review if Trump attempted to ease or end the sanctions against Moscow. But if Trump were to veto the bill, he risks sparking an outcry from Republicans and Democrats and having his decision overturned. The sanctions review was included in the bill because of wariness among lawmakers from both parties over Trump's affinity for Putin. The precise mechanics of how involved House Democrats would be in the review process had been a key sticking point, but Hoyer said he was pleased with the outcome. The legislation ensures that both the majority and minority are able to exercise our oversight role over the administration's implementation of sanctions, Hoyer said. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer called the sanctions legislation strong, and he expected the legislation to be passed promptly. Given the many transgressions of Russia and President Trump's seeming inability to deal with them, a strong sanctions bill such as the one Democrats and Republicans have just agreed to is essential, said Schumer, Democrat of New York. Early Saturday morning, House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy posted a legislative business schedule that shows the sanctions bill will be considered Tuesday. McCarthy had pushed to add the North Korea sanctions to the package. The House had overwhelmingly passed legislation in May to hit Pyongyang with additional economic sanctions, but the Senate had yet to take up the bill. The Senate last month passed sanctions legislation that targeted only Russia and Iran. Congressional aides said there may be resistance among Senate Republicans to adding the North Korea penalties, but it remained unclear whether those concerns would further stall the legislation. The aides were not authorized to speak publicly and requested anonymity to discuss internal deliberations. A nearly united Congress is poised to send President Putin a clear message on behalf of the American people and our allies, and we need President Trump to help us deliver that message, said Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland, the top-ranking Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee. The House and Senate negotiators addressed concerns voiced by American oil and natural gas companies that sanctions specific to Russia's energy sector could backfire on them to Moscow's benefit. The bill raises the threshold for when U.S. firms would be prohibited from being part of energy projects that also included Russian businesses. Although there is widespread support for the legislation, the bill stalled after it cleared the Senate over constitutional questions and bickering over technical details. In particular, House Democrats charged that GOP leaders had cut them out of the congressional review that would be triggered if Trump proposed to terminate or suspend the Russia sanctions. But Republicans rejected the complaint and blamed Democrats for holding the bill up. The review requirement in the sanctions bill is styled after 2015 legislation pushed by Republicans and approved in the Senate that gave Congress a vote on whether then-President Barack Obama could lift sanctions against Iran. That measure reflected Republican complaints that Obama had overstepped the power of the presidency and needed to be checked by Congress. According to the bill, Trump is required to send Congress a report explaining why he wants to suspend or terminate a particular set of sanctions. Lawmakers would then have 30 days to decide whether to allow the move or reject it. The North Korea sanctions bill, included in the package bill, cleared the House by a 419-1 vote, and House Republicans became frustrated the Senate didn't move quickly on the measure, given the vast bipartisan support it received. The measure bars ships owned by North Korea or by countries that refuse to comply with UN resolutions against it from operating in American waters or docking at U.S. ports. Goods produced by North Korea's forced labor would be prohibited from entering the United States. The sanctions package imposes mandatory penalties on people involved in Iran's ballistic missile program and anyone who does business with them. The measure would apply terrorism sanctions to the country's Revolutionary Guards and enforce an arms embargo.
Why Poland's government is being accused of destroying democracy, by Tara John. Despite growing unrest and threats from the EU, the government of Poland is on the brink of adopting a contentious law that critics say will unravel the country's democratic institutions by giving politicians influence over the courts. Weeks after U.S. President Donald Trump hailed Poland for its democratic values during a foreign policy speech in Warsaw, tens of thousands protested across the country against the ruling Law and Justice PIS party's erosion of the judiciary's independence. It follows a Thursday vote where lawmakers in the lower house of parliament passed a draft bill that would dismiss all members of the country's Supreme Court and let the president, on the request of the justice minister, make new appointments and influence their work. The bill is expected to be approved by the Senate on Friday before being signed into law by President Andrzej Duda. Here's what you need to know. Why is this happening now? It's part of a wider campaign to dismantle the country's democratic checks and balances on the government by the populist Law and Justice Party. It's part of a wider campaign to dismantle the country's democratic checks and balances on the government by the populist PIS, co-founded and chaired by the former Prime Minister Jarosław Kaczynski. Since winning a majority in 2015, PIS deputies have effectively turned the country's state media into a propaganda arm, purged the army's leadership, placed loyalists in the civil service, and weakened the constitutional tribunal, which rules on whether legislation violates Poland's constitution. The right-wing PIS says it's only following through on election promises to reform the judiciary. PIS supporters have criticized Polish courts for taking too long to hear cases. In a speech to the lower house on Thursday, Prime Minister Beata Szydło said the new legislation was a reaction to the court's alleged inefficiency, while insisting that the government will not bow to pressure from Polish or from foreign defenders of the interest of the elites. Former Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk, who is the current president of the European Council and a bitter critic of Kaczynski, accused the government of dragging the country back in time.
It is my belief that its most recent actions go against European values and standards and risk damaging our reputation, Tusk said in a statement. They transport us, in the political sense, in time and space, backwards and eastwards. Will the bill become law? It looks like it. PIS has a majority in both the lower house and the upper house, the Senate, of Parliament. The vote comes after two other laws passed in July. Under one, members for the body that chooses judges, the National Judicial Council, will be selected by Parliament instead of other judges. The second bill empowers the Minister of Justice to appoint and dismiss the heads of regional and appeals courts. How is the European Union responding? Is this why the EU is threatening to revoke Poland's voting rights? The political and economic bloc is threatening to revoke the voting rights of member state Poland. Frans Timmermans, the first vice president of the European Commission, warned on Wednesday that the EU was very close to pulling the never-before-used sanction Article 7, which would deny the country a vote on European Union business. But that provision needs to be adopted unanimously by every other member state. Hungary, which is led by Kaczynski's ideological ally, Prime Minister Viktor Orbán, has said it would not go against Warsaw. The problem is that the EU doesn't really have the tools to deal with a member state that's threatening to leave the path of democracy, Marcin Zaborowski of Visegrad Insight told the Financial Times. The EU has a stick to deal with aspirant members, but once countries are members, there's a limit to what it can do to persuade them to change course. The bloc has also clashed with Poland on issues ranging from a logging initiative in one of Europe's oldest forests to the country's refusal to take on any refugees. Can this be stopped? Not in Parliament. Poland's opposition parties lack the majority to block PIS's legislation, and there isn't a unifying political figure to counter the Eurosceptic party's clout. But if popular rage builds further, the PIS could back down. Recent polls suggest that 76% of Poles oppose a politicized judiciary. It may be the country's most popular party, but PIS only won by a slim margin in the 2015 election. Their majority is weak, and the party has backed down in the past when faced with popular pressure, specifically after massive nationwide protests in 2016 against a strict abortion law. Majority of women say their interest in politics has increased since election. By Jack Brewster. More women than men say that their interest in politics has increased since President Trump's election, according to a new poll. A Pew Research Center poll released Thursday found that 58% of women say they're more interested in politics since November, compared to 46% of men. Overall, 52% of Americans say their interest in politics has spiked since the election. Trump won the election by strong support from male voters, winning men by 12 points. According to exit polls, the 2016 election was decided by the largest gender gap in recorded history. Interest has spiked the most among Democratic women. 63% of Democratic women say they're more attentive to politics, compared to 54% of Republican women. Democratic women are also most likely to say that they've gone to a political event since the election. The Women's March, which happened the day after Trump's inauguration in protest of the president, was likely the largest political rally in U.S. history. Overall, Democrats are about three times as likely as Republicans to say they've been to a political gathering, 22% compared to 7%. For the majority of the country, the election of Trump is still stressful to talk about. The poll found that 59% of the country feels it's stressful and frustrating to talk about politics with people who don't share their opinion of Trump. More women, 64%, than men, 54%, feel this way. The best retirement plans if you're leaving a company to start your own. By Lynn Azanoff. Are you leaving the corporate world to freelance, become a consultant, or open a bed and breakfast? When taking the self-employment plunge, saving for retirement is probably the last thing on your mind. Setting up a retirement account, however, can be vitally important because doing so can help you cut your taxes and accumulate resources for later life. Retirement plans for the self-employed vary considerably, each with different annual contribution limits, filing deadlines, and rules governing employees. So, when selecting which plan is right for you, you have to start by considering your goals and priorities. Among them, if you want to make things easy, an SEP IRA, SEP stands for Simplified Employee Pension, is a good beginner plan, says Katie Brewer, a virtual financial planner based in the Dallas area. They're easy to set up and there isn't a lot of paperwork. You can open an SEP and fund it up until your tax filing deadline, including extensions. As a one-person business, your contribution is limited to 25% of net income after deductions, effectively 20%, or a 2017 maximum of $54,000, whichever is less. If you want to maximize contributions, bumping up against the SEP contribution limit, then you might want to consider a so-called solo 401k. These plans, which are also referred to as individual 401ks or one-participant 401ks, often let you tuck away more money, although the paperwork is a bit more complex, says Michael Solari, a financial planner in Bedford, New Hampshire. With a solo 401k, you can contribute both as the employer and the employee. In 2017, the basic employee limit for all 401ks is $18,000, with a separate employer contribution of up to 25% of compensation. The maximum for the two combined is the lesser of 100% of compensation, or $54,000. For those 50 or older, there's a catch-up contribution, bringing the maximum to $60,000. If you're thinking about adding employees, this is where things get trickier. You can't participate in a solo 401k once you hire employees. Independent contractors aren't considered employees, so if you're planning to hire an office manager or sales representative, for example, you need to consider retirement plan alternatives. SEP plans do allow for employees. With an SEP, however, you'll need to contribute the same percentage for all employees as you contribute for yourself, up to your effective 20% maximum. The simple IRA, however, lets the employee decide how much to contribute, with the employer matching up to 3% of compensation. Combined contribution limits for the simple can exceed $12,500 or $15,500 for someone 50 or older. Alternatively, the employer can contribute 2% of compensation to the simple up to a maximum of $5,400. If you're thinking about doubling down on savings, consider the impact of contributing to both an individual retirement plan and your business plan, says Grafton Cap Willie of CBIZ Tafias in Providence. You could, for example, contribute to an IRA in addition to your SEP or solo 401k. Once your income starts rising, however, you may bump into caps that limit your ability to contribute to either a traditional deductible IRA or Roth IRA. If you want to boost your Roth power, you've no doubt heard of Roth IRAs and Roth 401ks, where contributions aren't tax deductible, but all growth and qualified withdrawals are income tax free. Well, there are Roth solo 401ks too. Only the employee part of the solo 401k contributions is eligible for Roth treatment. The employer contribution is treated as a regular solo 401k. This hybrid setup can provide some big advantages. For one thing, Roth 401k contribution levels are higher than with a Roth IRA, says Clint Lodice, senior manager of Vanguard's retail retirement centers. Someone under 50 can tuck away up to $18,000, $24,000 for someone 50 or older. And unlike the Roth IRA, he says, there are no annual income limits capping eligibility. It's Okay to Be a Coward About Cancer, by Josh Friedman. Friedman is a screenwriter and producer for film and TV, including War of the Worlds, Terminator, The Sarah Connor Chronicles, and the forthcoming Avatar 4. In the fall of 2005, weeks after selling a pitch to turn the Terminator movie franchise into a scary robot television show, I ate a bad farmer's market burrito and ended up with kidney cancer. It's not an uncommon diagnostic journey for the disease. You set out expecting something familiar, for me, food poisoning, but quickly find yourself at a partial lower left nephrectomy. You can pretend you know what it feels like to have cancer or how you'd respond to the news, but you're lying to yourself. That's okay. Lying to ourselves about mortality is what separates us from cats. I spent most of my time crying. Well, crying, pulling myself together, rocking my son to sleep, crying more, and then taking Ativan so my wife could rock me to sleep. A month after my diagnosis, I fell asleep staring at the surgical theater lights and listening to the opening verses of Born to Run, thanks to a sympathetic anesthesiologist. When I woke up, the tumor was gone, but the feeling of cancer was still inside me. My body was now a sinister stranger. It had betrayed me. It had snuck up and tried to kill me. I would never trust it again. But it didn't matter. We both knew I couldn't escape. On the day after surgery, I lost a foot race to the far cancer ward wall to a guy who just had his colon removed, a distant cry from my days as a teen sprinter anchoring the 400-meter relay. I knew then it'd be a long and painful recovery. I banned my friends from visiting and spent my recovery staring out a hospital window, listening to music on my headphones, and wondering if I'd see my boy grow up. In my more optimistic moments, I decided I should quit writing the scary robot show before I'd actually started. It all seemed ridiculous and disconnected from my life. And for once, my performance anxiety and my existential anxiety were working together. No one would be mad at me if I just stopped. Not exactly a profile in courage, not even in the most favorable lighting. Screenwriters are the worst kind of cocktail party a-holes. We know just enough information to get us through the exposition scene in the first act, but not enough to be useful to anyone about anything after that. One of the things I know nothing about is cancer, especially my own. I never researched it, never went online to read up on it, never stared it down, and never really asked my doctor much of anything. I didn't even know he was cutting out my rib until I was lying in my recovery bed and it was gone. My spirit animal is whatever happens when you get a chicken and an ostrich drunk and give them a room. But I do know this. Cancer doesn't give a damn how tough you are. Cancer doesn't care if you stared down the North Koreans or won the Tour de France or wrote two seasons of a scary robot show. Since the senator from Arizona's diagnosis became public, I've watched well-meaning people tell a brave man to be brave. Give it hell, John. Fight. They're worthy words and always spoken from the best place, but they're not the words I've heard from other cancer survivors in the last few days. We know the dirty secret. You don't battle cancer. You don't fight it. If cancer wants you, it sneaks into your room at night and it just takes you. It doesn't care if you're John Wayne or John McCain. The tough guy narrative is seductive. It suggests we have control over our fate, that we can will cancer away. These are lies we tell ourselves, and for some patients that's helpful. It gets them through the day. For them, it's a useful tool. But courageousness is a standard that no sick person should feel like they have to meet. As a storyteller, I think hard about the tales we tell. Toughness and courage are staples of our cultural business, but these are not how we survive cancer. We survive cancer through luck, science, early detection, and real health insurance. If we survived through courage, I probably wouldn't have. When I did end up writing the scary robot show, I found myself clashing with executives over how I depicted the heroes. I argued that bravery in the face of death shouldn't be the default setting for a protagonist. It was okay to see people fail and be afraid and let themselves and others down, because that's mostly what we do. But pop culture glorifies courage and lacks empathy for weakness. And when we glorify strength without understanding weakness, we end up with a toxic version of heroism that suggests there's a morality associated with survival, that bravery and goodness are linked, and that the fearful and the cowardly are somehow lesser and get what they deserve. And when we do that, we can no longer tell stories of grace or forgiveness or connectedness. We can no longer tell stories about real people. These are the stories we need more than ever, especially those of us walking on life's edge. If you believe stories are lies we tell so that we can learn the truth, we best be careful what lies we tell ourselves. Because the truth is, there's a Terminator out there for each one of us. But when it finally finds you has nothing to do with how fast you run or how tough you are or how good a person you've been. Here are the first words I wrote when I'd recovered from my surgery, the words that came to me and made me realize that I could write the scary robot show. It's the opening narration played over a dark, onrushing road. I will die. I will die, and so will you. Death gives no man a pass. You won't find those words in the show, though. The network made me take them out. Too scary.
Why Trump's New Hire Marks a Turning Point for the White House, by Zeke J. Miller. In President Donald Trump's operations, experience often takes a back seat to familiarity, trust, and a keen eye for what pleases the boss. So it made sense that Anthony Scaramucci was brimming with confidence when he took to the White House podium Friday, just hours after being named Trump's new communications director. Scaramucci, a smooth-talking New York financier, has almost no experience in Washington politics other than as a writer of checks to members of both parties, but he knows both his audience and his way around a television camera, and spent much of his first 34 minutes at the podium emphasizing the close personal affection he has for his new boss. The appointment of Scaramucci, which triggered the resignation of beleaguered White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, may mark a turning point in an administration that is increasingly under fire. His hiring signals that a president increasingly irritated by the Russia scandals and congressional stalemate is putting his instincts ahead of the counsel of his most trusted hands. In hiring Scaramucci, Trump overruled the advice of his chief strategist, Steve Bannon, and chief of staff, Reince Priebus. Even Spicer's decision to throw down a him-or-me gauntlet didn't persuade the president. Instead, Trump relied on the guidance of his daughter Ivanka and son-in-law Jared Kushner, both of whom pushed for the move. For 6 months, Trump had tried it the Washington way, hiring veteran Republican hands to lead his communications shop. But both Spicer and former communications director Mike Dubke, who resigned at the end of May, lacked the most important currency in the Trump realm, a rapport with the boss. Neither was sure of their place in his orbit, and therefore neither could speak authoritatively for the president. Spicer, a Washington fixture, best known as a strategist and flack for the Republican National Committee, labored under the impossible task of defending a president who never quite trusted him and often embarrasses his press shop by contradicting their answers. Within seconds of taking the podium, Scaramucci proved he was in a very different situation. His first act was announcing that Sarah Sanders, Spicer's deputy, would be the outgoing press secretary's replacement, naming such hires as a task traditionally left to the president. Scaramucci, a Harvard-educated lawyer, has spent his career navigating the hard-charging New York finance scene. He isn't the first wealthy financier to find a valued place in Trump's inner orbit. Trump has demonstrated a penchant for placing trust in those whose success is independent of his, like Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, and Director of the National Economic Council Gary Cohn. The new hire's easy demeanor and self-effacing answers about his past failures and middle-class upbringing drew an instant contrast from the man he was replacing, and he hewed to a cardinal rule of life in the Trump employ: keep the focus on the chief. Scaramucci's obsequious display of fealty and devotion may have elicited groans, but they were tailor-made for an extra special audience of one. "I'm very, very loyal to the president," he declared, adding at least four times that he loves the man in the Oval Office. Scaramucci dodged questions about the ongoing Russia probe, saying he'd yet to have been briefed by the White House counsel on the limits of what he can say in public. But he failed to avoid some of the same pitfalls that have plagued his predecessor, as he found himself defending Trump's unfounded claim that 3 million or more illegal votes were cast in 2016. "There's probably some level of truth to that," Scaramucci said. "There isn't." And he dismissed pessimism over the GOP's health care bill and the president's dismal poll numbers. The president has really good karma, and the world turns back to him, Scaramucci said of the health care bill. Pressed on Trump's approval ratings, Scaramucci went further, spinning a yarn about how poll numbers are only an accurate reflection of a moment in time. The American people are actually playing a long game, he said, and I think they really, really love the president. It was just the sort of answer the president loves.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the Daily Edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.